Hi, I'm Grant Bartley from Philosophy Now magazine, and you're listening to the Philosophy Now radio show. Today we're going to be talking about teaching philosophy to children and young adults. I have with me Peter Worley from the Philosophy Shop.
Hello.
And who's been teaching young children aged between, well, from three upwards for about 9 years. And we'll be talking about his motivations and techniques for teaching people something so difficult, or apparently difficult. Also with me in the studio is John Holroyd.
Hello.
Who's been teaching philosophy to teenagers from 14 to 18 for about 25 years. This edition of the radio show is in conjunction with the current edition of Philosophy Now magazine, where I work, which features several articles on different aspects of teaching philosophy to children. If you are interested in what you hear today, then it's out now, and if you can't get it from the newsagents, you can order a copy at philosophynow.org. So first, I want to ask you, Peter, what is the Philosophy Shop and what do you do?
Right, well, we've recently become a charity, the trading arm of the Philosophy Foundation. Uh-huh. And what the Philosophy Shop does is that we work in schools, mainly primary schools at the moment, but also secondary uh-huh. schools. And we provide philosophy sessions for the kids, but also training for teachers on questioning skills, inquiry skills, and stuff like that.
Okay, so that brings out this, I suppose, the first question is, what is philosophy and why is it important to you?
Ah, yes, this question. Well, what is philosophy, of course, is notoriously difficult. It's a word to define. So I think one should always be careful about trying to say exactly what philosophy is.
But in your view,
I think if we say, I think the best thing to do is to provide a kind of working definition for the purposes, for my present purposes. So I think for me, philosophy is to do with things like second order thinking,
which means what?
Meta level thinking.
No,
well, thinking
jargon.
Without jargon. Sort of, so rather than, give a nice simple example, rather than doing philosophy, you might be thinking about what philosophy is.
Yeah.
Might be a nice example of the sort of thing I'm talking about.
Right.
Or you can take this example with any subject. So doing history is one thing, uh-huh. but actually asking the question what history is.
So it's analysing concepts or ideas or the meaning of words?
It could well be, yes, that's right. And I think that brings us on to another important aspect of philosophy, and that would be what you might call conceptual analysis.
Uh-huh. Taking
terms that you are using and actually thinking about what they're built up of, what they're made up of in terms of meaning, and how we use them.
Okay, John, what's philosophy to you, and why is it important to you?
Yeah, well, I would say that philosophy really is about the skill of thinking logically.
Okay,
it's about the techniques of putting together clear, coherent, articulated arguments.
About anything or about any particular subject?
It can be, but I think that it is particularly interesting where, because of the nature of the subject, the arguments are difficult to construct. So, for example, we might think of ethics, which uh-huh. is a whole branch of philosophy.
Which is what?
Which is about the theory, really, of what is right and what is wrong.
Morality,
theories of morality, and there it becomes philosophical partly because we find that when we really start to dig into the question uh-huh. of what is right and wrong, mm-hmm. we find ourselves not very far in asking the question, what do these words actually mean?
Okay, so that's a bit like what Peter said there.
Yes, it is. Yes, it's analysing concepts. Uh-huh. It's realizing that they're not straightforward.
Right.
And this also makes us wonder and makes us ask more questions uh-huh. and makes us dig more deeply.
Okay.
I think we're starting to hit upon something really crucial about philosophy here, and it's got something to do with the second order stuff we're talking about.
Yeah. What do you mean by second order?
Second order. Going back to what I said at the beginning about not doing philosophy but talking about what philosophy is.
Uh-huh.
And I think the problem with defining something like philosophy is contained in the very nature of doing the second
itself,
order thinking.
Yeah, right.
So the moment you say it's about arguments, or the moment you say about this, there's always going to be a philosopher somewhere who says, but is it?
Is it?
And they'll say that actually there's a sense in which the arguments are not the crucial part. I mean, we also talked before about the role of empathy in identifying with someone's position.
Yeah.
So I think this is the crucial thing, is the moment you try to pin down what philosophy is, because of its second order quality, it therefore becomes open to question.
Well, I mean, I could give you a possible, like, so suppose it's thinking about ideas. Would that be it? What would be wrong with that definition of philosophy?
Oh, gosh.
I think that a number of sort of working definitions are a good place to start.
Yeah.
And I think that there's nothing too wrong with having that as a place to start. But it's not any sort of thinking about ideas. I think it is quite critically...
OK, what's specifically specific about philosophy?
It's about analysing the ideas. It's about questioning the ideas. Uh-huh. It's about also, as well as critical thinking, saying what does this word right or wrong mean? It's also about kind of bringing ideas together and seeing how they relate. How does, for example, the idea of equality, which is a very, very important idea, what are equal rights? Well, how do we work out what they are? And how does equality relate to justice?
Okay.
To take another sort of example, and it's not simply burrowing down into an idea.
Yeah.
It's also about what I call lateral thinking, this connection between a series of different concepts.
So we could perhaps say that, you know, the whole idea of philosophy is even can be encapsulated, like you say, in thinking about what philosophy is itself and analysing that concept. Peter, you say you teach children critical thinking techniques, obviously as part of philosophy. What do you think children will learn or gain from learning critical thinking, and what wider use are these skills?
I suppose this comes from... I hope that the children gain the ability through using critical thinking skills, if that's what we want to call them.
Well, what would you call them?
Yeah,
I mean, you're the one
question.
Who's teaching them.
Critical thinking skills is often used. It's a term that's used in schools. Schools understand that.
Yeah, term.
So it's a good one to use in that sense. But
what do you mean, like, for people who don't know what it means?
For those who don't know, critical thinking skills, I suppose, would be the things, the ability to take arguments, propositions, claims that are made, and then to think about whether they make sense. Think about whether they
are true,
whether they're
false,
well-reasoned,
okay.
and all that sort of stuff. So a classic example would be to look for fallacies.
Right.
And fallacies are arguments which appear on the surface to be good, but in fact they have something wrong with them.
So it's possible that you're basically teaching them how to argue well. Is that right?
How to argue well. But if we just leave it there, then you're in the realm of sophistry and rhetoric. So just learning to argue well could just be learning how to win an argument.
Yeah.
So we need to be careful to distinguish between that and learning to come up with an argument which isn't just persuasive to the person who might be hearing it, but actually has, I suppose, some truth to it.
Okay, how does that chime with what you do for teenagers, John? I mean, are you teaching them critical thinking, or are you teaching them something beyond that?
I don't think you can properly teach philosophy without teaching critical thinking.
Yeah.
I teach the International Baccalaureate philosophy course.
Uh-huh.
And, for example, there we look at a unit called People, Nations and Cultures.
And that's for 17-year-olds?
17-year-olds, 18-year-olds. Uh-huh. That's the age group that does the International Baccalaureate. Now, in that, yes, we look at, for example, the concept of multiculturalism.
Uh-huh.
And we ask, now, what is a multiculture?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I've got one student, for example, at the moment who's thinking of writing an extended essay on the question of the coherence of a multiculture.
Right.
And these are very, very important questions for our time and for our lives. And so it is applying rules of critical thinking.
Right.
It's things like, you know, analysing David Cameron's speech, for example, about multiculturalism in Munich. Are his ideas coherent? He talks about, for example, tradition and community and shared experience.
Okay.
Do these ideas make sense? Or, for example, are we going to start asking questions like, well, we don't all have one shared experience. We have many different experiences that overlap with a whole variety of groups of people. So it's about applied critical thinking in areas that are important because they're about truth, because they're about justice, they're about what is good.
Okay, so really basic things.
I'd like to come back to the sort of my area, which is the work in the schools, the primary schools, and link it to what John's saying, because it seems to me that the critical thinking stuff that's done at A-level is left too late, in my opinion. So doing a critical thinking A-level, for instance, is a little bit like trying to cram French, you know, a whole language skill overnight. It's not going to happen quickly enough. And, of course, one of the problems that we're faced with is that many universities are complaining more and more about the lack of critical thinking skills in the undergraduates. And I have a feeling it's because there's not enough of it going on at the younger age.
This is where what motivates you to go into primary schools.
That's exactly right. So we're interested in, I like to call them, rather than thinking skills, thinking habits.
Right.
So they're learning how to they're learning how to have a disposition towards thinking in this way, rather than learning all the arguments and looking at them and saying, this is this fallacy, but I'm actually not going to use it.
Yeah,
I've seen it, I've learned it, but it's not second nature to me. It's not become part of how I am and how I think. Whereas if you start this much earlier, and you can.
So you'll be wanting them to gain critical thinking skills by the time they've reached a GCSE level, basically.
Well, that's the plan, yeah.
Okay, so now we're going to play the next track, which is Down in the Woods by Nutmeg City. Okay, that was Down in the Woods by Nutmeg City. And now we're going to talk specifically about the techniques Peter and John used to teach children and teenagers philosophy. First of all, I'm going to mention your book, The If Machine, Peter. It seems specifically designed as a handbook for teachers and others who would want to systematically stimulate or nurture the ability of children to think critically for themselves. It presents your method for teaching philosophy in classrooms, honed over 9 years' experience, I imagine, and shows anyone interested how they can use those methods themselves. It's got over 24 lesson plans. So, Peter, I wonder if you could tell us a bit about what you do when you go into a primary school class to teach philosophy to children. What is your method of inquiry that you highlight in your book?
Wow. Well, it might take me 9 years to answer that question.
Yeah, well, how about a couple of minutes?
Right, so, first of all, I go into the classroom and I'm faced with 30 children, let's say, of all different... different ages, but they tend to be the same age at the same time.
Yeah, suppose it's 6 years old, for instance.
That's right, okay. So 30 children all sat around in a sort of horseshoe shape.
Yeah.
So they can see each other, they can see me, they can see the board. I'll usually present them with some kind of stimulus to get them going.
Right.
And the if machine is obviously full of stimuli for those purposes. Mm-hmm. Then they're given some time to talk to each other, maybe, or think it through together.
So give me an example of what you mean by stimulus.
Okay. Well, my favourite one is probably the Ship of Theseus example.
Right, which is what?
Where it's us. Taken... The Ship of Theseus is a thought experiment that Thomas Hobbes introduced. And it comes from the ancient Greek myth of
English
Theseus.
Civil War philosopher.
Yeah, that's right. Comes from the ancient Greek myth of Theseus,
right.
Who, of course, defeated the Minotaur and was helped by Ariadne. Well, at some point during the story, he sails on the sea for many years in this ship. And what Thomas Hobbes said was, well, if you imagine the ship is each time a part of the ship needs replacing, it's replaced with a new part.
Right.
And this goes on, say, over 7 years until eventually the ship's been completely replaced.
Right.
And the question you might ask the kids is, do you think it's the same ship?
At the end, of when all the parts were replaced.
Exactly, as when it was first set out.
Yeah.
And I've begun to use, to make this sort of visual and kinesthetic as well as auditory.
Right, that's really nice jargon.
Teacher jargon, actually, this one. Trying to make the learning match all the different kind of learning styles that you've got in the classroom. Kinesthetic being those that learn by doing.
Yeah.
Auditory being those that learn by hearing, and the visual obviously being those that learn by seeing things. So I'll usually take some pencils or something like that, and I'll have I'll make a ship shape out of the pencils on the carpet.
Right, okay.
A mast with one of the pencils and a piece of A4 paper will make the sail. And then as I'm explaining how it works, I'll demonstrate by doing it. So I'll take one of the pencils away and replace it with another pencil, which looks exactly the same.
Right.
And then I do it with the second pencil and go all the way around until they're all replaced, including the sail.
Okay.
And we have a pile of the replaced pencils next to us. So they can see exactly what's going on here.
Yeah.
And when they get to think about what the question is.
So you don't do you tell them the question first, or do you tell them the story and then ask them the question afterwards?
Well, I usually, this particular stimulus is specifically philosophically focused. So I usually begin by asking them the question, what I call a task question.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the question that we start with. However, interestingly,
is it the same ship at the beginning as at the end?
Absolutely. But interestingly, even within that what seems to be very narrow focus, there is a huge amount of range where it could go.
Yeah.
So you've got questions of materialism. You know, the kids can often get wrapped up in whether it's the same thing, whether it's actually the same stuff.
Yeah.
And then they might end up putting the other parts together, for instance, to make another ship to try and show that they're not the same.
So which of those ships is the real ship if
exactly.
you make the...
But just yesterday, a whole new line of inquiry came up when one boy said that, he said, well, even the tiniest change to the ship, even if you move one pencil a tiny bit, which he did by getting up and doing so, he said this would change the whole ship.
Right.
Because each part is connected to all the other parts. Then he went on to say something really kind of...
How old was this guy?
This boy was, he would have been 10.
Right, okay.
No, 9.
Right.
And he went on to say that every time you step into the school, every time you tread on something, it changes the school, which in turn, he said, changes the whole world. So
That's a deep thought for a 9-year-old.
Deep thought for a 9-year-old, and it really, really had a profound effect on the rest of the class because they really struggled with it. But that was something I hadn't heard before after doing this for how many years.
That's brilliant. Okay, so and then they'd be talking, you'd get them to discuss it, and then you'd bring them back together and give answers to you or something.
That's exactly right. So they talk in pairs or small groups about what they think. Then, well, after a few minutes, they'll come back together to share their ideas together. At that point, the whole class talks.
Uh-huh.
I will use a ball to manipulate the discussion to sort
of give the ball to the person who's talking.
Exactly. And all sorts of ways to find out who's got something to say.
Yeah.
The kids have a hand signals to identify whether they're responding to someone or whether they're coming up with a new idea. And you get a kind of, the idea is to build a kind of dialectic.
Which means what?
Dialectic is a kind of what you might...
A dialogue.
Dialogue where each idea is building or in some way responding to other ideas in the group so that they start to change each other's minds, they start to build perhaps, if you like, a sort of... You sometimes hear arguments that no single child says but kind of are structured by what a number of children say, for instance. So what you might call a ghost argument. But sometimes the kids will say arguments explicitly themselves as well. So this process of working together collaboratively, if you like, builds... a sort of ship of reason, if you will.
Oh, that's brilliant. Okay. Now, how would that differ from how you would, say, teach what I would call A-level 17, 18-year-olds?
Yes. Well, I think that you have more sort of focus on discussion a lot of the time.
But, I mean, suppose you were just going into a class. How would you start the lesson in the class? Would you get them to read something beforehand, or what would you do to start a lesson?
Yes, you might do that. You might start off by asking a question.
Give me an example.
So, you know, what are your ideas about justice?
All right.
Or, you know, to take something that we... Or are we free?
Uh-huh.
So you're talking about freedom and determinism, and just getting their ideas out there, really.
Right.
Just go
and
around the class.
And you write them on the board,
yes.
would you, as they come
yes.
up?
Yes, or on the whiteboard.
Uh-huh.
On the computer screen, yeah.
Right.
You know, that's one way. Or you might show a clip from a film.
Right.
We use a lot of film in what we do. I think one great way of introducing things is actually to get them to feel certain things. So to give an example, one film that I've come across recently, Memento, is about someone who has lost all of their memory, really. A great deal of their memory.
All of their long-term memory.
All of their long-term memory. And to ruin the film for anyone who's listening...
Block your ears now if you want to avoid
don't know
this.
the sequence works so that you go back, you have a little clip of this person's life, and then 5 minutes later in the film, you have an earlier clip of his life, and then 5 minutes later, after an interlude of something else that's going on, you have another clip.
So it's going backwards in time.
And I think the incredibly clever thing about this is that you, as someone who is watching this film, you get to feel something of the confusion of losing your memory.
So what sort of question would you ask on that film, then?
We might be looking at the question of what does it mean to be, rather like the ship, the same person from 1 minute to the next, from 1 day to the next, from 1 year to the next, and from birth to death. And if we don't have memory, or if our memory is corrupted in this kind of a way, then what does that do to a sense of our identity? Are we continuous? But the great thing about a film like this is that it brings their own personal experience, having watched the film, to the table. It means that they're not coming kind of just with their ideas.
Yeah.
That they have actually...
They've got something to relate it to.
And it's particularly emotional. I think that's very powerful as well.
They can attach their feelings to their thoughts.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, so, for example, another question that brings up their feelings would be to say I'm teaching sort of slightly younger children, sort of 14, 13-year-olds. I might say, write down, first question when you go into the class, write down an example of something you think is not fair.
Right.
And then that brings, something that you've seen or observed that you've thought has not been fair.
Right.
You've got to be slightly tricky. They might talk about a colleague or whatever. Yeah. So this brings their experience and their engagement immediately to the surface.
Right. That's interesting. It's almost like, because at the beginning you were saying that the philosophy is about logic and argument. Mm. But interestingly, it's like the hook, the way in which we engage with it is perhaps more to do with the emotional response.
Yes.
So that's quite interesting that we've got, that they've both come up this evening.
Okay. Yes. Right, Peter, you say in your book, The If Machine, you say that ifing, what you call ifing, is a particularly good way of developing critical thinking. What is this ifing that you're talking about, and why is it a particularly good way of developing critical thinking?
Well, basically, it's hypothetical thinking.
Which means what?
When one considers a situation which isn't the case, but maybe. So whenever you say, if it were raining, it would be wet, for instance,
or
any sentence that begins with an if, you're saying something which might not be the case, but then we think we're considering what would follow from it being the case.
Okay, so to be more speculative, say if robots had really complicated circuitry, would they be humans or would they be people? That might be one, for instance.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah. And I've noticed that when working with children, not just children, anybody for that matter, what you want to do is you want to try to, if you want to do philosophy with someone, but you want it to be coming from them.
Yeah.
One of the problems you're faced with is letting it all run freely and then it just not being philosophy. If you let it run freely, it could go any direction.
What's the difference between letting them have a free discussion and it being philosophy?
Well, that's a big question in itself.
Sure.
But I suppose if you're wanting them to come... I suppose... let me try and explain one of the main problems with philosophical discussions, especially when you're dealing with children... who don't know really what they are.
Right.
They very often come across things like factual or empirical, and by empirical I mean factual considerations, things that it might not be the job of philosophy to answer.
Yeah.
So, for instance, scientific
like
questions.
What is the facts about this, and that's not what you're interested
exactly.
in so much.
Exactly. Yeah. And it often is a stumbling block for discussions. So a very simple example of ifing is when you might imagine a discussion where we're talking about people swapping brains.
Right.
If you swap brains, where would you be? Two people swap brains, where would those two people be? And very often children might say things like, well, you can't swap brains.
Right.
It can't be done.
Right.
Now, it's very easy as a teacher to get wrapped up in whether or not you can.
Mm-hmm.
Or another classic example that I come across a lot is in discussions about colour. Someone will say, black's not a colour. And then someone else will say, well, yes, it is. No, it's not.
Okay.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And I myself have many times in the past been drawn into these discussions, trying to answer them, and then getting onto the internet and to see... And it really does get in the way of a good philosophical discussion. So a very simple way of getting around this is to what I call if the fact.
Yeah,
which is, as you can imagine, you simply say to the child, well
if it was the case that you could swap brains, then what would be the outcome?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's the most basic, sort of, if you like, atomic version of ifing. But it can be used in all sorts of more sophisticated ways. So, for instance, either oring the if is when you take somebody's idea and you get them to if it one way, and then you get them to if it the other.
Yeah.
So, for instance, I had a discussion with some children about how many horns a unicorn has.
Right.
Which, as you can imagine, is very philosophically fertile because of all the stuff about non-existent entities. But one girl said that, well, unicorns do exist.
Yeah.
You just have to be lucky to see one.
Yeah.
Suddenly, all the other children were wanting to mock her, to say that they didn't exist and all this, that and the other. But all you need to do, using the ifing strategy, is to say, well, if they did exist, how many horns would they have?
Right.
And then you go the other way.
Yeah.
If they didn't exist, how many horns would they have?
That's interesting.
That way you've got them to consider it both ways. The child has now thought about what follows from it being the case that they do or don't exist. Mm-hmm. But nobody's had to be told that they don't exist. Nobody's been needs to be made fun of. So it has both a philosophical and a pedagogical usefulness.
Okay.
And there are plenty of other examples in the book of that kind of strategy.
Okay, John, if your discussions was getting off track for older teenagers, I mean, what would be your strategies for getting them to focus on philosophy rather than a discussion of facts, or is there any particular methods you'd use there?
Yes. I mean, it's often possible to you just ask a question often.
Like?
What do you mean when you say that we're free? So mm-hmm. you're discussing freedom and determinism. Someone might have got into, a factual discussion about genetics, say, and be relating something that they're doing in science. And, that would be a way of just gently steering things back on track, really.
Oh, so you're sort of always pointing them towards the analysis of the ideas, is that right?
Well, that's one thing in terms of, techniques to steer people back towards philosophy as opposed to something factual.
Right.
I mean, what I find is that during the sixth form, I have to do that less and less,
right.
If at all, in fact. And I'm working with really pretty bright children, and I think that through practice, they actually pick up a sense of what it is they're doing. And while they might not be able to articulate this, they do have a picture that they're looking at the meaning of words. They're looking at how they apply to reality. If they apply to reality, what is reality? They've got some sort of framework of that. So in fact, you do have to... I would say with sort of 14, 15-year-olds, mm-hmm. If you're talking about philosophy, which I do, then you find yourself having to do a bit more steering.
Yeah,
at that level.
I've found that working with 14, 15-year-olds actually harder than working with 8, 9-year-olds in terms of the focus.
Why?
So I don't know why this is exactly, but the sort of thing I'm talking about is if you ask focused questions to 9-year-olds, they tend to stay pretty focused, uh-huh. and their ideas seem to connect to the ideas that went before in a reasonably logical mm-hmm. and systematic way. But when I've worked with some 14-year-olds, suddenly that seems to go, and you get this kind of almost word association kind of thinking, whereby someone will come up with an idea, which will, and one of the words in that idea will make the other person think of something which has no logical connection, but starts them off on a completely different. And within 3 or 4 contributions, you can be on a completely
different
topic. So
it's sort of like intellectual one-upmanship, maybe.
Perhaps. I'm not exactly sure what's going on there, but it seems to be much harder work, I seem to think, working with that age group in terms of just keeping it focused.
Okay.
I think that often an enthusiasm can take over In terms of they want to make their contribution. And it's, I think what can sometimes be tricky is you don't want to kind of dampen enthusiasm at all, but sort of bringing people's contributions round and affirming the individual and each person while kind of, you know, steering things a bit.
That's a crowd control, is it? Yeah, is that what it's?
Well, no. I mean, because it's well-meaning sort of contributions, but just gently trying to, you know, steer things while also. Because often people, while they're not saying something philosophical, that they are making a meaningful and intelligent contribution. Uh-huh.
All right. OK, we're going to go on to the next track here, which is Sid Barrett and Effervescing Elephant, which is a philosophical lesson in animal ethics, let's say. This is Grant Bartley from Philosophy Now magazine on the Philosophy Now radio show on Resonance FM, and we're talking about teaching philosophy to children and to teenagers. We've talked a bit about different techniques for teaching these young people. I've just got some various questions here. Peter, you teach philosophical critical thinking to children as young as four. What sort of philosophy can you possibly teach to children of that age, and how do you do it?
Well, it's less a case of teaching them the philosophy and allowing them to kind of discover it.
So what? Yeah, but what are you getting? What could a four-year-old discover about philosophy then, if I put it that way?
What you mean? What sort of philosophical ideas can they discover?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I already talked earlier about the question of identity, and that's something that can be done with many age groups. I've also done sessions with, six-year-olds on part-whole relationships. So if you were to just make make a little man on the ground, and ask the children how many things are there here?
Yeah.
You might get a variety of different answers, from one, because there's a man, to seven, because there's seven pencils that make the man, to eight, because you've got the seven pencils plus the man.
Okay.
You know, and all this sort of stuff. And you might have, no, there's only three things there, because there might be three, four pencils and a ball and a box. So they'll say there's three. There's pencils, ball, and a box.
I'm getting the idea that there's no particularly correct answer to any of these questions that you ask people.
I suppose what I'm interested in them identifying is identifying tensions, controversies, and problems.
Right.
Because it seems...
Going back to the teaching argument skills and critical thinking skills.
That's right. So what I'm keen to do is I don't simply put that pencil man there and ask them that question, because if I do, I'm likely to just get the same answer, which is however many pencils there are.
Yeah.
So what you need to do is to try and give them a context in which that tension comes out to them.
So what would you do?
Without saying it to them yourself.
So
I use stories a lot. I use a lot of stories. So, for instance, with that particular example, I would begin by telling the story of the elephant and the six blind men, which you may well know.
Yeah.
This is the famous story in which there's an elephant in a tent or something, and there's some blind men, in my story, blindfolded, and they each go in to find out what's in the tent. And because they're all feeling a different part of the elephant, they describe what's in there as something very different from each other. So one holds the tail, one holds the legs, one holds the trunk, etc. So in my version, the children don't know it's an elephant that's in there.
Right.
So they just hear the descriptions from the wise men.
So it's a rope, or it's a tree trunk, or it's a hose.
You've got it. And at the end, there's a list of six different things, and the discussion is how many things do you think are in there is what I first asked them.
Yeah.
So some of them will say, well, it has to be six because they're all so different.
Mm-hmm.
Some will say it might be something that's changing. There might be different rooms with different things in there. It might be a castle in which you've got a spear and all this, that and the other attached to it. Now, as a result of coming up with all these ideas, they start to explore for themselves the concepts of part-whole relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So they're starting to already consider. One of the kids might say, for instance, well, it could be a castle, because that would have the spear and that would have the door and that would have the tree. And then you might say, well, if it were a castle, then would that be one thing? Or would that be many things? And they might say, well, that would be one thing, because they're all attached.
Yeah.
So they've already started to get into
analyze
this...
analyse their concepts.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
So I call this a primer discussion, because the kids are having the primer discussion. They're having this discussion where they're exploring the concepts for themselves. And then when I put the pencil man on the ground and say, how many things are here? That's when you're guaranteed to get lots of different answers and for those children to disagree with each other. And when that happens, you know that they've identified a tension, a controversy here,
right,
rather than a straightforward, well, there's eight, isn't there?
Okay.
And that's what I'm looking for, is to find a way to draw for the children to identify the tensions and the controversies, and for those controversies to then fuel the conceptual analysis, if you like, or
okay,
whatever it is that they go on to do.
All right, John, what differences are there in teaching different ages, and what are the differences in responses, and what are sort of different problems associated with different ages?
Yes. Well, I think that in terms of problems associated with different ages, that with sixth form... 17, 18-year-olds. And I think this comes to something that Pete was saying a minute ago. It takes some 17, 18-year-olds some time to actually get into this process, having had no introduction to philosophy in their earlier years, to actually kind of really start to manage to take apart concepts and arguments at quite an advanced level.
Isn't that true of anybody who's just being introduced to philosophy, though, do you think?
I agree. I think it is. I think that it is conceptually difficult. And you use a wide variety of techniques. I mean, things that I do, for example, is you take an argument, you simplify it, you cut it up, and you get, you know, a group of pupils to, you know, arrange things in a logical order.
Uh-huh.
Kind of talk about an issue, as I say, steer the discussion, get pupils to sort of stand in a line, kind of in terms of where they agree and disagree with a particular concept, you know, and then they've got to justify their place on a spectrum in terms of agreement and disagreement. But I think that, it's important that pupils feel that they are in a safe environment, they feel confident,
mm-hmm,
that they're not going to be shot down.
Yeah, so they want to be able to express their views and not be ridiculed, basically.
Absolutely, but also because I think what's very important is that they can get things wrong, that they can, you know, leave a sentence half finished, that they can sort of, oh no, I've not got this right, and that's just fine. That it's all the time just trying and trying.
You
and trying.
Want to encourage them to develop their ideas.
A concern I have in general with teaching, particularly the teaching of philosophy, and particularly with the teaching of philosophy with young children, is that very often the expression "there are no right and wrong answers" is used,
yeah.
I find this concerning because it seems to be the case that people have this view of philosophy that when you're doing philosophy, that there's no way in which it can be wrong or right.
Yes.
And this doesn't seem to be right either. however, the problem I've been left with for many years is how do you get this, strike this balance between having a safe environment, as you say, for the kids to be able to explore their ideas and without being condemned or shot down, but at the same time not telling them what I think is the false, but giving them the false belief that there are no right and wrong answers.
Yeah.
So for this reason, one of the things which I'm very keen to do is for the children to learn how to analyse each other's arguments, how to criticise each other's arguments respectfully,
mm-hmm,
so that people understand, as long as it's done in the right kind of way, it's appropriate.
Mm.
And then what they do is that without me having to tell anyone who's right and wrong,
mm-hmm,
plus the fact I don't necessarily know who's right and wrong,
yeah,
they will themselves start to identify what are the good answers and what are the not so good answers. And interestingly, they will identify even in themselves what's a good answer and what's not a good answer. And I think that the interesting thing is the dialectic process. This I spoke earlier about the process of building on each other, listening to each other and reasoning with each other and criticising each other. That process has a kind of self-regulatory function.
Yes, I'd absolutely agree with that, and that's the ideal, where, in fact, you're intervening not too much and they are sort of managing to manage a philosophical discussion for themselves. And when you've got to that point, then I think that you've got a very long, long way.
But without necessarily everyone thinking that everyone's right.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it is this sort of dialogue between the psychological, that people need to feel able to speak, not threatened by the situation, and at the same time the philosophical sort of agenda, which is that, you know, a relativism where we say, well, you know, this idea is right in this culture and this idea is right in that other culture, and we can't, you know, kind of therefore have any sort of dialogue. And that's something that you know, in Nature and Cultures course.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're aiming to foster what might be called correct ways of arguing rather than saying this is a correct answer. You can say this is a wrong way.
I think that might be right, yeah.
Wrong way of arguing or something.
Yes. I think that's right. And also the crucial element of self assessment. So, for instance, you know, I often get asked, especially by the young children who are used to a culture of finding out what the answer is at the end of a session. Or So I often get asked at the end of, say, doing the Ship of Theseus or the Pencil Man stuff, what's the answer?
Right.
So can you tell me the answer now?
Yeah, I'd ask you that.
And it's an interesting one. I've had to think very long and hard about how I respond to that. But I've eventually discovered to taken the line that it's better to engage them in that very question itself. This now brings us back to the meta level stuff I spoke about right at the beginning. So rather than giving them some sort of answer or not answering them at all, I now say to them, well, if I told you this, would that be the right answer? Or would you agree with me? Yeah. Or if I told you the, and then I might either all the F and go both
they're
ways.
They're still involved in the process of doing philosophy.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, brilliant. Now we're going to pretend to be marooned pirates, courtesy of the Coral. This is Skeleton Key. Hi, this is Grant Bartley from Philosophy Now magazine on the Philosophy Now radio show on Resonance FM, and we're talking about teaching philosophy to young people. So I want to put this open to both of you. Can you think of any particularly memorable or surprising insights, yeah, that's a bit of a Freudian thing, isn't it? Insights your students have come up with, or insults maybe even.
Yes, I think that what has sort of surprised me is when I ask pupils, OK, you've got to do this 5,000-word extended essay as part of the International Baccalaureate,
right.
And the topics that they come out with, and off their own bat, you know, the things that they investigate that are often off the syllabus, they've gone off.
Give me an example.
Well, I had one student who read a book that is absolutely undergraduate level by a Danish philosopher called Søren Kierkegaard, read Kierkegaard's book Fear and Trembling, which is really an analysis of the Abraham Isaac story.
Right.
And the issue of faith. Uh-huh. You know, if Abraham lived today, he'd be locked up for taking his son and being prepared to kill him.
Right, yeah, it's
what
true.
Makes Abraham a hero of faith then and now for many religious believers, but if someone actually did that now, they generally speaking would not be.
It surprised you that they come up with this topic to start
well
with.
This was not something that we'd studied. This young man decided to analyze the concept, give a philosophical analysis of the concept of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And every year, you know, I get students who go completely away from what we've done and from their own interest focus on something that inspires them. And I think it's that independence, you know, that I find inspiring all the time. And okay. Another thing, the wonderful thing about teaching philosophy, among many others, is that you walk into a class and their insights, their questions. I mean, I've got one class at the moment, and, you know, they ask so many questions. Mm. And that is just wonderful.
Okay, brilliant. What about you, Pete?
Well, there was one...
Briefly.
One thing I do remember is a girl called Eve, who said, why? She said, if we can't see atoms,
right,
then when I look at my hand, I shouldn't be able to see anything.
That's clever, isn't it? Well, how old was she?
She was, at the time, 10.
Right.
And, I mean, I wonder if...
So what's the answer to that, Pete?
Well, the interesting thing is that we were... There was a group of philosophers in the room at the time, and
that's
we
a
all...
a good collective now, and a grump of philosophers.
We all looked puzzled.
Right.
They all looked grumpy.
Yeah.
Because we couldn't work out how to do this. Then there was a 10-year-old boy who said, well, that's easy.
Yeah?
He said, the reason is because you can't see an atom, but you can see atoms.
Right. Collection, like, yeah, these clever people that you're dealing with, right? Okay, we just want to round up with some plugging now. So, Pete's book is The If Machine, and as I say, this is a handbook for teaching philosophy to primary school children. Would you say?
I'd say primary up to early secondary.
Yeah. Okay, and you can get that from Pete's website. Which
any age,
is,
really, any age.
Which is your website?
Is thephilosophyshop.co.uk.
Right, and suppose that somebody wants some more in-depth teaching. Are there courses or anything that you're...
Yeah, we run courses for particularly aimed at philosophy graduates who want to work in primary schools or secondary
right.
schools doing philosophy. And we run courses, our stage one course, our next one I think is the weekend of the 2nd and 3rd of July.
And then anybody interested, just go to
the website,
which
it's
is
there.
Again?
Thephilosophyshop.co.uk.
Right, okay. And you've got a round table coming up?
Got a round table event at the LSE, which is on the 23rd of June.
Uh-huh.
It's from 5 till 7:50
p.m. And what
does
that mean? Anybody can turn up?
Yes, it's anyone can turn up, and it's also free. So that's
right.
worth
so, coming And you'll to. Be talking about philosophy for children.
That's right, from the point of view of practitioners, also academics and policymakers, to talk about the implications of philosophy in the curriculum.
Okay, and John, have you got anything you want to plug?
Well, yes, I would say for anyone listening who is interested in finding out more about philosophy, there's an organisation called Philosophy for All. Mm-hmm. It meets the first Wednesday of every month in a pub called the Exmouth Arms near Euston. You're welcome to go on the PFA website and find out more. It's the whole idea is that it's designed for people who don't know anything about philosophy mm-hmm. at all as an introduction. And you have children who would like to find out more about philosophy and you live in South East London, St Dunstan's is a great place to study philosophy and religious studies, along with many other subjects too.
Okay, that's brilliant. Well, I'm Grant Bartley from Philosophy Now magazine, and we've been presenting this programme in conjunction with our special themed Philosophy for Children issue, which is out now. And I should say that my book is called The Meta Revolution, M-E-T-A, and is available as a hard copy from Amazon or as an electronic copy from Smashwords. The next edition of the Philosophy Now radio show is on the 15th of June, and I'll be discussing the mysteries of the quantum universe with Manjit Kumar. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.